NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. I hope both of you are recovered from our little adventure to Oshkosh and Air Venture 2025. It was a great show. We got to meet a lot of people. And thanks to those viewers and listeners that came over and said hello to us, gave us their input and, feedback. So we're taking that into consideration for future shows. So we look forward to another episode of Flight Safety Detectives based on viewer listener input. So that's great. Plus, we met a couple of folks from Dubai, Captain Hellman, Derek Hellman. He is a 777 captain, flies for Emirates, and his wife, Crystal. She is a psychologist into aviation, so she's merged those two. We had a great human factors discussion. You'll see a picture of John and I with them on the website. But again, it was a good show, and we'll have a few more things to talk about in future shows. But there was a recent event that took place just as we were coming back from Oshkosh in Denver, involving an American Airlines 737 MAX. This had nothing to do with the 737 MAX as an aircraft. And regardless of what anybody else wants to say, this could have happened to any aircraft. And John, you've gotten the latest lowdown. It was a takeoff accident or a takeoff event where it was an aborted takeoff. So why don't you give us an update, what you found out?
Well, from what I found out is that the airplane was taking off and it had a tire issue as it was accelerating towards V1. And it actually had a tire blow. It was over 100 knots when it occurred. And the captain aborted the takeoff. When he aborted the takeoff, he applied brakes naturally and move the airplane in reverse. But when the tire actually separated from the airplane, it broke a hydraulic line. And so while he's going down the runway, because the line was broken and he's got the brakes on, he's pumping hydraulic fluid out. And the brakes and an abortive takeoff get very, very hot. And it ignited the hydraulic fluid. So he had a small fire in and around the landing gear. The other tire also let go, the one that stayed with the airplane. So the airplane looked like it was very much down on the wing, but it appears that it escaped any damage to the engine. And it was all just contained to the landing gear itself. The passengers escaped the airplane over the chutes. There was one injury in evacuation. There's a video from the passengers that one passenger showed the tire actually leaving the airplane, heading across the ground out into the open field, and also shots of the people coming down the escape slides. And the idiots a number of idiots on the airplane that are carrying their luggage with them. And I hope one of those is one of the ones that sustained injury, just to teach them a lesson. And I don't know what we're going to do or how we're going to get a handle on passengers taking their belongings with them. You know, in a real emergency, you could delay the departure. And yeah, maybe you get your butt out of the airplane with your bag, but you may have someone else stuck in the airplane that doesn't make it out. And they're selfish people.
Yeah. Was that over the wing? Was that people going out over the wing? I can't remember.
No, they went down four slides.
Because I think they opened the wing.
I think some people got out on the wing, but I don't think
I was just thinking that the flight attendants should have made them drop those bags and not take them with them as they were going down the slide. So, if the NTSB is getting involved in this investigation, definitely the FAA is. If they had come down a chute where there was a flight attendant at that chute, somebody's got to ask some questions because they should have stopped that person, made them drop the bag, get rid of it before they went down the chute.
Throw it out to the side, not down the chute.
Yeah.
But it happens too many times, so nobody's saying anything to them. Yeah. And maybe they did say something and they totally ignore them too.
Yeah. Now, do we know if the abort was due to something else, or did the abort take place because of that tire letting go?
It's not clear, 100% clear. And I'm sure American Airlines has downloaded data off of the quick access recorder to try to determine that. The pilots naturally have not made a statement yet. So it's a little early for the outside world to know what's going on. I'm sure the American Airlines internally is looking at that. But the initial reports that I've received, just people on the scene, indicates that the tire blew and then the abort.
Well, the good thing is that crews are trained for events like this, these high-speed aborts. This crew, because the airplane from the picture I saw looks like it's still on center line. And like you said, John, when both tires let go, put it down on the strut itself. There is a picture that will be posted on our website looking from the right side of the aircraft through to the left side. And you can see that the left engine, at least the engine cowling is sitting on the ground. So, hopefully there isn't that much structural damage to that particular engine. But again, this airplane is going to be out of commission for a while during the course of the investigation. With that being said, we got an NTSB preliminary report on a Cirrus that crashed that ended up being a fatal accident in North Carolina with a family of four. Of course, there has been a lot of information that's already been pumped out on the internet about this particular accident, but we started looking at this. And again, while we were at Cirrus while we were at Air Venture, there were a lot of folks that have already talked about the obvious things and the fact that this particular event really started well back right after takeoff with the pilot reporting that he had an electrical issue with the airplane. Why don't you just give us a synopsis, Todd, since you really dug into this, and then we'll get into a few of the details and, of course, question a few things and hopefully identify things that the investigators either have looked at, should look at, or hopefully will look at with regard to this event.
Well, certainly. This was an accident that happened on July 7th of this year, and the preliminary report came out fairly quickly, about 10 days or so afterwards. And what you had was a Cirrus SR-22 Tango taking off from Merritt Island near Cape Canaveral, going north up along the Atlantic coast initially toward Raleigh Executive Jetport, which is near Raleigh, North Carolina. Shortly after takeoff, it's not clear how long after takeoff, according to the report from the NTSB, there was some kind of electrical problem. Given the weather conditions, it might have been within sight of land, but they were off the coast. They had issues with communication and they were unable to use regular communication. At some point in the flight, and the preliminary report is not clear, one of the passengers, apparently the wife of the pilot in command, was using a cellular phone to contact the FBO at the destination airport, looking for weather and other information. Now, again, the information is a bit sketchy in the preliminary report, but evidently the problem manifested itself fairly early in the flight. This was a flight that would have taken several hours, and for whatever reason, the crew was heading toward their destination no matter what. Looking at the limited record of this particular aircraft, it was owned by the pilot in command. It had flown in the previous 11 and a half months or so at least 115 times. This is according to Flight Radar 24. And looking at the data from that source, the vast majority of the flights of that 115 or so were between the destination airport, Raleigh Executive Jetport, and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. About 89 in total of those 125 flights. And many of the other flights were either to or from Myrtle Beach or Raleigh. So we're presuming that Raleigh was the home airport or one of the home airports of this particular aircraft. And it didn't have that many other flights that were in different places. One thing that stood out, the last two flights were to and from Merritt Island down near Cape Canaveral. In the previous 11 and a half months, there were no flights going that distance and no flights going to that airport. It took off on July 4th in the morning, and it was coming back on July 7th. And for those of you in America, you probably know that that was the three-day weekend. July 4th was on a Friday, and July 7th would have been the first working day back the following week. And given that the person had two children and a spouse on board, it would appear that this, I'm assuming, that this was a pleasure trip. And looking at the data, it was definitely a trip that was out of the norm for what's usually done with this aircraft. The pilot was a private pilot, had gotten his license in the early part of 2024, so roughly 18 months since having their private. And according to the FAA, this person had no instrument rating. Doesn't mean the person didn't have instrument training. That's something that might come out during the investigation.
It's part, you get basic 3 hours of instrument related training as part of your private pilot course.
One thing that did, I find a bit disturbing on the two flights, the accident flight and the immediate flight before that, the person who was flying off the coast, the East Coast of the United States over the Atlantic Ocean. And looking at some of the ADS-B tracks, the aircraft was roughly 20 nautical miles off of the coast. Now, full disclosure, I don't know the glide ratio of that particular model, Cirrus, nor do I know the weight and balance of that particular aircraft, but it just stood out to me. Would you really want to be flying 20 nautical miles off the coast in an aircraft? Now, one can do that if you have the proper amount of equipment on board, but given that the vast majority of the flights of this aircraft were fairly short compared to this accident flight, and very few of them were in any way, shape, or form off the coast. And this particular flight had two young children on board. This is something I'd like to see the NTSB address. Was the aircraft properly outfitted to fly that far over water?
Yeah. Well, again, when you're talking about survival equipment, water survival equipment, I think offshore the regulation states that if you're greater than 50 miles now. Being at 11,500 feet, 20 miles offshore, again, the glide ratio for that airplane, regardless of whether it's max loaded or not, is based on weight and how the pilot would fly that. Because even though there's a lot of glide information in various flight manuals, pilots do not absolutely fly the airplane in a glide at the particular glide speed. We don't know if he had had a problem offshore, whether or not he would have made it, but being 20 miles offshore, over water without equipment, it does bring up at least a question for the pilot that if he has to put the aircraft down, is he prepared to ditch the airplane because he may not make it to to shore. What happened as they got closer to Raleigh, because those, like you said, the electrical problem apparently started to really cascade, took out more of the critical systems, and that being the fuel system, given the fact that those fuel gauges are electrically driven.
Now, one thing that we stress, especially John stresses at the end of nearly every episode, is the use of checklist. You have to use a checklist. You have to follow procedures every flight. And there was one line in this preliminary report that really jumped out at me. The airplane was equipped with a Cirrus airframe parachute system, CAPS, which was not deployed. The handle inside the cockpit used to deploy the ballistic parachute in flight was found to have the ground securing pin installed. We actually spoke to some Cirrus representatives at AirVenture, and they reiterated what we knew ahead of time, that removing that pin is one of the standard things that's done during the pre-flight of this aircraft, because even though in theory, if you forget to do so, you can remove the pin and pull the handle. In an emergency or a situation where a lot of things are happening very quickly, that's not the time to think, oh, maybe I should have done my pre-flight checklist. So it's unclear whether it was not removed because there was some sort of pre-existing fault with it where it could not be removed, or if this pilot just didn't remove it. Nor is there any information in this preliminary report saying whether or not this pilot had a habit of not following checklists and procedures. But again, I do hope that the NTSB looks into this aspect of it. The aircraft also was found with very little fuel, about 3 gallons left in the right tank, no gallons left in the left tank, even though the left tank was breached. One of the things that was pointed out, and I don't know if this was at AirVenture when we were talking to the representative, but without electrical power, the gauges don't work. They're electrically driven. Without power, you have no information. And in the preliminary report, it was reported that the spouse who was calling in was saying that they had no navigational or electrical equipment working. So it's says to me that they would have had a hard time understanding the state of the aircraft and the position of the aircraft, even though they might have had the help of flying off the coast. Coming into Raleigh, you're definitely inland, and it's unclear. In fact, it's sort of confusing what sort of visibility they had. According to the NTSB preliminary report, they had broken clouds at about 1,400 feet at the time of the crash. According to information we can get from past weather reports from that area, the past weather reports we can pull up show that the weather was much better than broken at 1,400 feet AGL. So I'd like to have some clarification in the final report. What was the visibility conditions at the time of the crash?
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
You know, there's a lot of confusion out there around the FAA requirements. Most people don't realize that the FAA requirements are the minimum standard.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's not the best. It's just the minimum.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to see. We don't necessarily say you have to do X, Y, and Z. We just want you to do more than the minimum required of you. Because obviously, the more you do, the better pilot you will be.
Great. And then, how are you received when you try to encourage pilots to go that extra step or go above and beyond? Are they resistant to it? Do they say, well, you know, I get enough training or I do enough flying, I don't need to do that?
Honestly, the majority of the pilots that we deal with are willing to go that extra mile. Or when we tell them their discounts are available, they're already doing it.
And if I choose to do that additional training, what do I have to provide to you so that I get credit for that?
You have to just let us know. You give us a call, tell us what you're doing, we'll document it, and we don't need any documentation sent to us.
Great.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
Yeah, that's always a question. Now, that airplane is equipped with two alternators and two batteries. So that electrical problem, if they didn't have navigation and they didn't have radios, they must have dumped both batteries, John, because they should have had at least something. And given the fact that they crashed, you know, within or about 5 miles from the airport, the thing that is painful to even think about is, one, the flight manual. When you get into any kind of electrical issue in a Cirrus, it's basically telling you, put the airplane back on the ground as soon as practical. You don't just continue. Like this guy said, he told ATC, I've got a problem, I'm going to keep going. Why would a pilot even think that? Now that brings me back to, what kind of training did this pilot get in the Cirrus? Where was his operational discipline? Was he aware of all the critical information in that manual for him to have made a decision? One, not to turn back and land at the airport that he had just come out of. Two, he reported when he was about in the Daytona Beach area, there's a number of airports, of course, Daytona Beach International, Ormond Beach, it doesn't matter. You knew Smyrna, you can land at a number of places. Why didn't he put the airplane on the ground? Now, as Todd said, he's flying off the shoreline 20 miles without any kind of, he may have gone that far off thinking, well, since I don't have navigation and I don't have radios, I'll just fly way out over the water to stay out of everybody's way. That makes no sense at all. Why you would venture out that far? But he overflew a number of airports flying up the coast. He should have had that airplane on the ground. But I've seen it before. We've seen it before. These guys try to milk the airplane back to their home airport, thinking they don't want to leave their airplane somewhere else. It's time. It's money. Guess what? It's called safety. It's called reasonable. And oh, by the way, you got your family on board. You're not going to be a hero when you kill them. And so it's very frustrating that this was definitely one of those types of accidents that was senseless. It was ridiculous. And while it's a tragedy that a very prominent, well-known family that gave back to the community, there was a lot of human interest stories about this family. The fact is that bad decision-making, can happen to anybody. I don't care how prominent you are, how, nice you are. The fact is that this guy should have never put himself and his family in a position of jeopardy like this, making bad decisions.
Now, there's a training aspect of this that we became aware of when we were at AirVenture. We spoke to some Cirrus representatives, and they told us about their, I can't remember the proper name for it, basically a Cirrus transition program. Any person who buys a new Cirrus has, as part of the purchase price, a transition program where they tell you how to fly that particular airplane. And that program is offered free of charge to anyone who buys a used Cirrus. This particular Cirrus was manufactured in 2012. This person had their private license in the early part of 2024. I'm assuming that the person didn't buy this aircraft brand new out of the factory. So my question, more the Cirrus than the NTSB, is this someone who would have gotten training from Cirrus prior to taking possession of this aircraft?
Or if he bought it used, did he take Cirrus training as part of that transition program?
And more importantly, was he offered the training but refused it? Or offered the training and took it, or was never aware of it at all? Those are three options, and maybe there are other options. But again, I would hope that the NTSB steps up and looks into this aspect of the accident.
You know, one of the things that's overlooked in the electrical failure portion of this, and I think one of the reasons why they recommend that you get on the ground right away, is even though you have two batteries in the airplane, running that equipment is going to run them down, as we see in this case, maybe in an hour, 15 or less, maybe less than an hour, you're going to run them down because the airplane is so electrical. But there is one other overriding factor. Even though this guy left the pin in, even if he had removed the pin at the point when he needed it, with the batteries totally dead, the chute wouldn't deploy, because it needs to charge that little rocket that shoots it out to inflate the balloon, the
parachute
bubble to catch the airplane, because it's so close to the ground, it doesn't necessarily do it on its own. And it needs electrical power to do that. And if he killed these batteries totally by trying to make it to his destination and run his equipment all the way, then he eliminated one possible safety feature. Cirrus builds in so damn much safety into their airplane. You know, we've had accidents because pilots have a fan belt breaks, an alternator belt breaks, right? And they inadvertently don't have any power. They're not paying attention. They kill the battery. We've seen that over and over years ago. So in this case, Cirrus runs one alternator, gear driven off the engine, and one with a belt, right? So you're not going to ever have a failure on that one alternator in the drive because it's gear driven to the engine. So having a dual alternator failure, pretty rare. Pretty rare. Yeah. Alternators are damn reliable. So it's this guy just through his actions negated years of safety that Cirrus has built into their airplanes.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, you know, again, it's the decision making. It's obvious that even though they supposedly didn't have any kind of electrical power to for flight navigation instruments, communication instruments, you may have had an iPad or something because the ADS-B track shows, you know, pretty much of a straight beeline towards Raleigh Airport, towards that executive airport. So he was probably using something. And like you said, Todd, is that misinformation in the NTSB report? Was that broken cloud ceiling at 14,000 feet, not 1,400 feet? Because if he was having to come down through 1,400 feet, he would have had to find a hole. And again, he's a VFR pilot. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is have to try and find a hole, pick a field, put the airplane in a position to land. Now, the airplane did crash in a big open field. It looks like the airplane stall spun, or at least was in some sort of very steep nose low attitude, because the pictures that I've looked at, that airplane hit almost vertical, bent the fuselage, broke the fuselage in half, and then relaxed back so that the front end of the airplane is sticking up in the air. Again, you fly the airplane into the accident. I just flew today, happened to be in Gainesville, Georgia. I flew with a pilot, and part of our pre-flight briefing in his Bonanza was, if we lose an engine on this particular runway, if we lose an engine, you know, at low altitude, we got no place else to go but into the trees, and I'm going to fly the airplane into the trees under control. Because you have to have it planned. And in this case, he would have had to do a self-briefing that, you know, without any kind of flight instruments, if he had to pop down through a cloud deck, which again, I find that hard to believe. But if he did, and he's got no flight instruments, and he had to go down through a cloud, it's very easy to get disoriented. So again, there are a number of things that need to be at least developed by the NTSB and ferreted out and validated, whether or not he did come down through a cloud deck, which could have contributed to a loss of control. He may have been trying to go for that particular field, but for the fact that other external factors, caused him to lose control of the airplane, that's yet to be determined. But these are the type of accidents where, with, like you said, John, with all these safety systems built into place, this is my big concern. And I just had this discussion with a number of pilots, and I had a number of discussions when we were at Air Venture. I'm worried that pilots who are able to afford technically advanced aircraft, Cirrus being one of them and others, they lack the skills, abilities, and knowledge to operate those aircraft. And what they lack in those skills, abilities, and knowledge, they're actually transferring that pilot and command responsibility to the airplane, because they have TAWS, they have terrain awareness, they have traffic, they have TCAS on the aircraft, they can project weather. So they have the weather information, and they have an autopilot that has that magenta line. And as long as that autopilot is functioning and follows the magenta line, they're going to blast off into all sorts of stuff, because the automation will fly better than they can. And now, with not only auto leveling, if they get themselves into trouble, but now they have an auto land. So with all of these devices, are they crutches? Are they enticing pilots that really should be very, very plugged into these technically advanced aircraft, are they basically disassociating themselves with the total operation of the aircraft and being the pilot in command? Are they transferring that pilot in command responsibility into the airplane, especially when something goes wrong? That's a real big concern of mine. And this is a perfect accident that demonstrates that this pilot didn't act as the pilot in command. And as pilot in command, you're making reasonable decisions. You're erring on the side of safety. You should have returned. You should have put the airplane down. You should never have tried to do what you did, because the result was disastrous. You took a benign situation and turned it into a catastrophic event.
Now, when we were at AirVenture, we talked to a lot of folks, including Cirrus folks, and frankly, some competitors of Cirrus. And some of the things that really stuck with me is the fact that Cirrus has a very good product, no question about it. Technically advanced aircraft can do wonderful things. And like you said, Greg, learning how to fly the airplane is more than just learning how to fly the airplane when everything's working. Learning how to fly when it's not working. Learning how to make decisions that are appropriate for the situation. And part of the marketing of Cirrus is not going after folks who are very experienced pilots, but people who are new to aviation. The Cirrus lifestyle, as someone described it. And again, it can be kind of enticing. This is a very sophisticated aircraft, way more sophisticated than most spaceships that the U.S. have produced with respect to the level of computer capability, visualizations, and all the other things that come with the high tech that we have today. But when you're new to aviation, even if you've gone through the certification for, let's say, being an instrument pilot, as you've said before in different contexts, getting that certification isn't the end, it's the beginning. It's a license to fly and especially a license to learn. And one of the things that can't be taught in a formal course is judgment and decision making, especially under stress. Preferably something you don't do when you're under stress, preferably something you get exposed to over and over again. So when that situation happens, the decisions you make err on the side of lower risk rather than higher risk.
Well, that sounds like a good second to the last word, Todd.
Almost good, done. Because my plan was to have the second and last word coming out of your mouth, because I heard that after AirVenture, you had an opportunity to fly in a private aircraft with a friend of yours. You and the friend, members of the family of the friend, got together, did the pre-flight, did the weight and balance of the aircraft, and I'll be less than diplomatic. There was excess weight on the aircraft, and his name was Greg. Now.
Not because I overeat, Todd.
Now, here's what I want to ask you, and this is my second to last word, again, through your mouth. How did you feel when you realized that that was the case and you would have to change your plans? And how is the fact that you probably had a plan B and C ahead of time made the decision easier from that moment forward?
You bring up a very good point, because when I showed up at the airport, we had already planned that I was going to fly with a friend of ours. And he's a very conscientious pilot. He has a Piper Lance. He had his wife, his granddaughter, and of course, all their stuff. So when I showed up at the airport early in the morning and we were putting their stuff in the airplane, I knew that there was just no way I was getting in the airplane with my stuff, because I'd already been on the road for a week and, of course, AirVenture. And it was one of those things where I said, you know what, this isn't going to work. There's just no way. The airplane is, you know, you got full fuel, you got the three of you and your stuff. I don't have a problem. I'll turn to plan B. My plan B was to drive down to Milwaukee, get on an airliner, a United flight to Atlanta. And I did. I had no problem because I had plan B. I knew it was going to be close. Our friend Don had already done the pre-flight planning, had done the weight and balance. He said, yeah, we're going to be right there. But when I showed up and I saw all their stuff, I said, we're beyond right there. So I didn't have a problem. It made it easier because I had plan B. I was able to drive down there, get on a flight, make it to Atlanta about the same time, actually a little earlier than what we would have done landing in Don's airplane. But he made it. He had a great flight. It was smooth. He had to just avoid some weather en route. But we erred on the side of safety. We are not going to take off overweight, thinking that, we'll burn off fuel and then we'll be good. It doesn't work that way. But I had plan B. And like you said, Todd, it made my decision very easy. Don was very apologetic we weren't going to be able to do it. But you know what? That's general aviation. You always have to have plan B. So I believe that's a very good second to the last word. So with that, John, we will leave you with our last word.
And as always, I would say to pre-plan, as you just said, pre-plan what you're going to do. Plan for the unexpected. When you get to the airport, plan a second time. And if they don't agree, then do it all over again. But make sure that your data is correct, your numbers are correct. When you get out to your airplane, do a very thorough pre-flight. I had a number of discussions with pilots at Oshkosh about doing a robust inspection of your airplane. And I used the example that one of our listeners sent us, the way he waited for an airplane to come in with a student and instructor. And he went out while they were doing their post-flight brief. And he went out and did an inspection on the airplane and found a bracket broken for one of the flight controls. And he went back in and brought both of them out to show it to them. So that, there's nothing like showing somebody when they made a mistake. And invaluable. Doing a good pre-flight is invaluable. And then after you get in the airplane, make sure you put your head on the swivel. I mean, Oshkosh was a perfect example. You needed more than just a swivel there. There was airplanes everywhere. And you had to, situational awareness was very, very critical in that kind of environment. So please, please do all your homework and fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
According to Avemco claims data, 34% of aircraft accidents happen on landing. Does this number surprise you? Avemco Insurance Company values safety and believes strongly in continuous pilot training and education to help prevent these accidents and promote safer skies for everyone. That's why they sponsor the Fast Team Wings program and the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Avemco rewards safer pilots with premium credits through their Safety Rewards program. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're one of our listeners. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety.